Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. In the studio tonight, we have with us the lovely, the intelligent, the fantastic Mira Achilles.
Hello.
Very good. So we have two brains in one. It's going to be an interesting program, and this is going to be a regular feature on Ask Dr. Dawn, is bringing in younger voices, and Mira has a fantastic voice and lots of good ideas and lots of good questions. So that is where we're going, but before we go any further, I want to start off with, this program is going to be dedicated to a large extent about AI, and our first story is about AI. AI beats doctors at ER triage. So this is a study that was done at Harvard University in the emergency department, and it found that artificial intelligence can outperform experienced physicians at diagnosing patients in the emergency department. Basically, they used OpenAI's O1 reasoning model and two doctors, and they were given the same health records of emergency room patients and asked what they thought was going on. The AI reached the correct or near correct diagnosis 67% of the time, compared with 50 to 55% for the doctors. Pitted against 46 different ER doctors, board certified, and asked to draw up treatment plans, it scored 89% versus 34% for the doctors. I'm wondering who did the scoring on that one. But if it was a professor of medicine, that would definitely fit, because I'm sure that the AI was more inclusive in the treatment plan. In one striking case, a patient with a blood clot that was deteriorating despite anticoagulants was one of the cases. And these were paper cases. The AI flagged something the doctors had missed. It suspected the patient might have lupus, an autoimmune disease that can inflame the heart, but also causes very inappropriate coagulation. So the AI advantage largely disappears when both the AI and the doctors are given more extensive patient data and also a little bit more time to think. But that implies that having a tool like this could be most useful in fast-moving triage situations. Still, it does show that the large language models seem to have advanced enough to warrant clinical testing. In another recent study at the Mayo Clinic, they found a different AI model could detect signs of pancreatic cancer up to 3 years before diagnosis, allowing early intervention and treatment for one of the deadliest cancers. Harvard's Raj Munrai, co-author of the ER study, says, "We are witnessing a really profound change in technology that will reshape medicine." And I want to double down on the fact that medicine, as we speak, is being reshaped by the existing AI, and we need to make that to be for better and not for worse. I attended a workshop recently about AI in medical education, and I was very interested in hearing how all the other doctors across the spectrum, from very newly hatched to very experienced, were using AI. It was fascinating, but also a little alarming, because residency is where you form habits of thought and reasoning that set up pathways in your brain to think through difficult or challenging situations quickly. Think about the difference between following a recipe and just kind of throwing the more or less right amounts of ingredients then, and then having the creative thought of, oh, let's try adding such and such this time. Also, if something starts to go wrong, having a strategy to fix it. Again, that is something that needs to be in your brain. We can't be relying on a device that we explain it to. And also, as we know, we always have to cross-check what we hear from AI. It reminds me of driving to a place yourself versus being driven to a place, and how much easier it is, or isn't, to retrace the route depending on how engaged one was getting there the first time. I have two stories about AI in clinical medicine. the one I've already given you is the one from this week's news. The other is a personal experience. In the case of the ER study, I'll just comment that 90% of the time it's something common and the playbook works. But when the playbook doesn't work, that's when dropping the case into open evidence to see what else pops up is a good idea. But starting with open evidence or ChatGPT 01 or whatever you're going to be using is problematic because of the zebra paradox or the zebra issue. And that's the probability equation that is in the back of every doctor's head. How common is this? Not just what are the presenting symptoms, but how common is this? Even if it sounds exactly like the rare disease by definition is rare. And the common thing presenting looking like the rare disease, that's where clinical judgment and clinical experience come in. And I think it's very important to keep that straight. My AI story this week is also a story about an unusual case of shingles and the implications of this case. A patient I had recently, about a month ago, got shingles inside her mouth and into her throat. And she's all better now. We treated her appropriately once it was diagnosed. And she asked me when she should get a shingles shot. Her ENT doctor had cleared her and said, go ahead and get it right away. But another provider had said, wait 1 year. And I want to emphasize, there's data in both directions. And so the trouble with data is it's averages. And averages don't reflect individual variation. And that's one of the problems with science, is the outliers can be severely wounded. And figuring out who's an outlier and who you have to be more careful with is kind of the moral of this story. Now, oral shingles is rare in and of itself. And it's often misdiagnosed as a toothache. Because the pain starts a couple of days before the blisters are visible in the mouth. And again, it's rare. So you're going to wait to see your dentist for the toothache, and they'll probably say, oh, this looks like herpes. But is it herpes zoster, that is to say shingles, or is it something else? This particular patient also gets lip herpes simplex 3 to 4 times a year. So I started thinking about her. Perhaps she's an outlier. Perhaps her T cells or some aspect of her immune system has trouble suppressing viruses in the herpes family. And one of the take-homes I took from the workshop was a paraphrase of the old saying, it's all in the wrist. People usually say that when they pull off a finesse in sports or some other difficult task. Well, my mind changed it to, it's all in the prompt with AI. So I gave a prompt to an AI that is not trained on the general internet because I wanted to choose one where I would avoid any anti-vaccine propaganda. I wanted actual data. I asked, is there any evidence of shingles being triggered by Shingrix? And here was the reply. Yes, there is a credible evidence suggesting a transient increased risk of shingles in the first 21 days after a first dose of Shingrix, although the overall body of evidence strongly supports the vaccine's safety and long-term protective efficacy. I'm going back to English, American style. A study published in Clinical Infectious Diseases last year analyzed two independent Australian data sets using case-controlled series methodology and found, get this, guys, an 11-fold increase in shingles presentation 21 days after dose one of Shingrix in adults greater than 65 years. This was a very, very solid, statistically significant data for those of you who understand what a p-value is. The p-value here was 0.0001. Unassailably real. Not a 1 in 10,000 chance that this was by accident. And at that point, you can just call that real. It was not detected in people under the age of 65, which is really interesting. And on the positive side, after dose 2, the risk of shingles was reduced in all the age groups. And after 2 shots, the risk was, there was a 73% reduction in shingles overall. They did not get more postherpetic neuralgia from their shingles. That makes it classifiable as mild. But what gives here? Shingles is a non-live recombinant subunit vaccine. That means it has no live virus, no varicella zoster virus. It can't directly cause or infect a person. The hypothesized mechanism here is that the robust immune activation triggered by the adjuvant, which is ASO1B, may paradoxically facilitate reactivation of latent wild-type VZV in some individuals. This is analogous to something called the immune reconstitution phenomenon, which is seen in other settings. Let's take a moment and talk about that, because this is an interesting phenomenon, and I suspect that it's more common than we realize. The symptom is called immune reconstitution inflammatory symptom, often called IRIS. And it occurs when humans with a severely weakened immune system suddenly begin to recover because their ability to attack recovers faster than their ability to control the amount of attack. They overreact. And if there's a previously hidden or previously treated infection, they overreact to it. We see this in HIV patients who, when they start on life-saving drugs and their immune system starts to come back, if they happen to also have TB, they get a really strong inflammatory reaction. The same thing happens when we taper people off of immunosuppressants or when we taper organ transplant patients off of anti-rejection drugs. If there happens to be another infection kind of sitting there at the root of the tooth or maybe in the lungs, you get a massive overreaction. The key word there is poorly coordinated. And that's because the reactive cells, the T suppressor cells, don't come back as quickly as the T warrior cells. And so you end up with a whole bunch of bloodthirsty troops without a general modulating and directing them and saying, no, back off there, overreactive response. And it's when those T suppressor cells, the T regulatory cells, come back online that we start to see a modulated, appropriate immune response. So the key points here, this is not an anti-vax discussion. This is a discussion about, that's interesting, a case study. I went looking at all of the references that Open Evidence gave me just to see what else was there. Interesting. Here's a case report of transient increase of shingles. Let's see. Here's one where a woman had herpes. She had shingles of the eye, and she'd had it off her cornea multiple times, and her cornea became inflamed about a few weeks after her first Shingrix vaccine, and it flared up. Boom. And she'd had one case back in like 2011, and then she was good for a couple of years. She flared in 2018, just on the regular suppressive appropriate therapy. And then she got her vaccine, and bam, 2.5 weeks later, she had it. Here's one of a person who got herpes zoster flare after Shingrix. Again, a person who'd had shingles in the past and flared up. She was in her mid-60s. And then I found this article, which really raised my eyebrows. It was this systematic review of case reports. And they found 91 cases of herpes zoster following COVID-19 vaccination. Wow. And it makes you think, well, that's that the previous theory that was in the first paper about it having something to do with, reactivating the latent herpes simplex virus. I'm like, that makes sense if they're the same antigen. But this really implicates the adjuvants to me. And I've thought that the adjuvants are too strong. I mean, I'm sorry, it's one of my hobby horses. And I think when you give a strong adjuvant that's really pro-inflammatory for a good reason, because people have less well-modulated immune systems when they're older, and part of that problem is that they don't react well to a vaccine. The other problem is they don't turn off well. Their immune system is prone to inflammation. So if you kick them harder enough, they tend to overreact. And I think that's exactly what we're doing with the adjuvants. But there are other hypotheses, like the one, the iris syndrome. And it looks like the iris syndrome. Sure. But anyway, of the people who, of those 91 patients who flared, and this is just the tip of the iceberg, right? These are the ones that somebody bothered to write up a case study and submit it to a journal for evaluation. And a lot of us are way too busy to be doing that. So if you get 91 cases, it's kind of like if you see one, I'm going to use an old Farmer John. Old Farmer John says, if you find one rat turd in your barn, you've got 100 rats.
Yep. Exactly.
Exactly. So anyway, that study had a really interesting practical hint at the end. So going out to all of you who have not gotten your Shingrix vaccine and are over 65, or people who have autoimmune disease, frequent herpes, previous shingles, HIV disease, obviously. But prior to getting your shot, maybe start on valacyclovir, which is the drug that suppresses the virus. I'm thinking that that's going to be one of my go-tos when my patients over 65 go for their Shingrix shot. I'm going to say, all right, all my usual advice, but also, do you get herpes? Have you had shingles? And if the answer is yes to either of those, I'm just going to say, let's put you on suppressive agents. Let's just belt and suspenders, right? And it's harmless. There's very few drug interactions. It's an agent that can be given freely and is given freely to elderly people, and we know it plays well with others. So am I giving an unnecessary antimicrobial? Maybe. But if I prevent one case of shingles, that is such a awful thing to get. And in the base of, and I have some people I'm really afraid that the Shingrix is going to knock them sideways and set them up for some other flare or other problem. And I am not anti-vaccine. But I like to think, I like not just to follow the phone call that I get from CVS telling me I'm due. I'm like, well, am I really due? Or are your bills due?
Exactly. And in this case, better safe than sorry.
Exactly. So what are your thoughts about AI and how are you using it?
So, I mean, with regards to AI and school-based practice, when it first started coming out, the rhetoric from professors was very, you're not allowed to use this and, you know, we'll mark you for plagiarism if you do. But a lot of students noticed that it was coming up, whether just on Google or discussions with peers. And so my thought process was more, how do we use it? And not a question of if, because students are going to use it, whether we want them to or not. So I noticed that UCSC had a couple professors discussing the ways to use it. And as you said before, the ways to critique it, which I think is huge here, because in the case of a global health study or a population study, it might be very useful in summarizing a very long article, but taking what it says with a grain of salt, I think, is key.
Trust but verify?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's true. Mira, how many of your age contemporary friends have ADHD or say that they do?
Definitely a big discussion in my age group, and I would say at a minimum I have 5 friends who I know for a fact have ADHD and have a variety of medication that they've used, and I would suspect a good 5 more of my friends have an undiagnosed.
There's a reclassification of ADHD going on. We talked about it last week, in that there are subtypes, and so some of that females tend to be more of the spacey daydreamer, males tend to be more of the leg jiggling fidgeter, ants in the pants type of thing. But the other subtype is more subtle. And this recent research coming out of China that was reported in the Washington Post caught my eye. They did brain scans of, I love China because they can, you know, do what they want. They had 1,154 children and adolescents. And they were looking at the idea that there was a dichotomy between hyperactive and spaced out. What they found, however, was a third type, and all of these showed distinct patterns in their brains. So the first two that they identified were the inattentive, spacey, and the hyperactive impulsive. But they found a third type showed the most pronounced changes in the brains, 45 abnormal brain regions compared with 26 in each of the other two groups.
Wow.
And it wasn't the same 26 in the more broadly recognized categories. But the fingerprint, if you will, brainwave or brain activity fingerprint of the third category, which they called severe emotional dysregulation, was much worse, 45 abnormal areas. The standard stimulation medication historically does very poorly for this group. As I was reading about that, this basically means the third type is emotional volatility. And that's something that wouldn't, the average person wouldn't call themselves ADHD if they just had a bad temper or they had mood swings. But they very well may have a type of brain dysregulation, and that really is what ADHD is, just an edge case. You're an outlier in terms of how your brain is wired. And maybe we have created more ADHD by the way we've allowed our children to wire themselves, or the way the childhood experience has changed, or maybe not. Maybe we're just getting better at discovering it. What do you think?
I think it must be a combination. I think our discovering capabilities have increased, and I also would argue that the short reward loop cycle of a screen has definitely changed, at least in my experience with young kids, their ability to focus and play outside and get into something for a long period of time.
Getting back to that third emotional swing, in my training, I was trained on a whole bunch of things that were not, they were called personality disorder. And it was intrinsic to the way the person was wired, although they didn't say that exactly with that term. The idea was this isn't something we can drug. It's not really a thing like depression that is overlaid on a, I'm putting quote marks, air quotes, normal brain, or anxiety, which is overlaid on a normal brain. It's actually an innate feature of that brain. So borderline personality disorder and histrionic personality disorder and something called hypomania, which is kind of a bipolar light. So in hypomania, people are very enthusiastic about projects. They'll take on too much. They'll kind of accomplish amazing things. Maybe they have trouble finishing them and they move on to something else, but they never, or they get depressed and don't want to do anything for weeks at a time, but they're not really depressed. I mean, they're eating okay and they're laughing and they're maybe just sitting and watching a bunch of stuff on TV, but they're dismotivated. So hypomania, it fits between personality disorder and these, you know, actual entities that we call psychopathology. Then histrionic is the real dramatic, loud, from tears to anger kind of person, very volatile. And then borderline personality, I always thought about that is sort of they will take offense at a slight and reject you. They don't, they're very thin-skinned, but while they love you to death and they're effusive and they give you gifts and they always want to be with you. And then you call them up one day and they're like, I want to talk to you. You know what you did. And you're like, totally like, what did I do? Have you ever had a person do that on you? Or
have you seen it? Have, and I suspect they're a Leo.
Well, I suspect that maybe they have some of those 45 aberrancies that were seen in the Chinese study. But now that we have this ability to look inside the brain and make fingerprints of neurologic activity, it completely changes the classification system. It's going to have to be seriously we're going to have to re-educate ourselves, particularly the psychiatrists.
Absolutely, because medication changes are, as you said, the traditional medications haven't really worked for some folks.
And also, the medications themselves do have, let's just say, some very unpleasant side effects, including diabetes, obesity. Mm. I mean, we don't want to drug people if they don't need it. And we would, am really excited about the advances that we may be seeing in transcranial brain stimulation. There was a grand rounds this morning about vagus nerve stimulation,
wow,
which is turning out to have all sorts of, you know, very unusual applications. The vagus nerve, of course, we talk about a lot on this program, and I talk to you about it a lot at work. But the vagus nerve, when you stimulate it, or when it is stimulated by one of these devices, it can actually remit rheumatoid arthritis. It can take care, it can cure or treat autoimmune disorders.
Wow.
There are a bunch of indications that seem, until you start thinking about the deep wiring, they don't make sense. But once you understand how much the vagus nerve touches everything, it's, for example, approved for the treatment of ulcerative colitis, which you think of as an inflammatory colon disease. But of course, the vagus nerve is talking to the colon, and the colon is talking back. So somehow, if you change the dialogue between the two, the colon calms down.
Wow.
Oh, brave new world. So we were talking earlier, Mira and I, off the air, about menstrual periods. And I was kind of patting around the head and saying menopause is totally worth it, and kind of gloating a little bit because, you know, my waistline doesn't change 2 inches a month, and I'm not like walking around with a towel between my legs. And, it's a rough ride to get over the hot flashes, and it's a moving target for a few years. It's totally worth it. I was thinking about how it teaches you that you're not in charge of your body. If you're a woman, the fact that you start menstruating at all and the fact that you keep doing it, not always at the most convenient time, and the effect it has on all of your systems. You described it beautifully. Can you dredge up what you said about the subjective experience for you of having a monthly cycle?
Yeah, I mean, it feels as though you have lost control to a certain extent, and the adolescent anxiety of, you know, someone seeing your tampon or having a mishap in your favorite clothes. And then as you get older, this like inability to just quote unquote deal or have a good day, and you're trying to be productive, but you get almost sabotaged at the worst possible times. And it can really affect different systems. For myself and my peers, I know some people get very intense anxiety, very intense nausea. Some folks, a migraine will accompany the period. And so I think for me, tracking those times with other symptoms has been key in figuring out my migraines or just grumpiness in general.
And I was just thinking, as I do, you know, there's, when bad things happen, there's a lesson. You might as well find the lesson and take that away, because at least it sort of mitigates the bad aspect a little bit. And, you know, what did it teach you? What it teaches you, all of this unpredictability in our own bodies, is it teaches you that you're not in charge of your body, that you are riding on top. It's like you're riding a horse, and the horse may shy at a snake or decide to run off towards the horizon, and maybe you'll drop the reins by accident, and the horse will decide to go in a direction you don't approve of. That's kind of what your body does. And I think men, for the most part, don't get their nose rubbed in the fact that they're not in charge of their body until they're much older. And so I think that I certainly see this when the younger they are, the more I see a real difference in how people react to a disease diagnosis, depending on whether they have experienced themselves as in a male body or a female body. And we're not going to get into trans and intersex, because I don't have enough knowledge about that to truly comment on it at this point. And I think it's very individual, and that there's really no way to make any generalizations about that. There isn't enough social pressure for generalizations to really apply in any broad way. But I understood from you that there are some attempts to maybe help men be a little bit more empathetic and experience a little taste of what it's like to be menstruating. So tell us about this new device.
Exactly. So any of you Instagram or TikTok listeners might have seen the iconic videos that went viral of the men having a stimulator put on their abdominal area. And this would create the feeling of a period cramp. And, you know, there's the medical point of it where it creates empathy and works by creating electrical impulses. But what I found so interesting was this dichotomy of the big, strong man in his office job coming in and then wiped out from a pain level of a 2 or a 3. And many women, you know, continue about their everyday lives with a much higher threshold. So the company is called Some Days, and they have a variety of period tonics and creams and teas. But their main selling point is this electrical impulse period pain stimulator. And if any of you are interested in bringing it to your workplace, their website is called Some Days.
Is that D-A-Y-S?
D-A-Y-S.
Okay. Yep. I was D-A-Z-E.
Actually. That would work. Oh, yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and read an email that we got here. This is from Sam in Missouri. Longtime listener here. I think I emailed you once every couple of years. This podcast episode on human evolution and hookworms reminded me of your past discussions about toxoplasma, its effect on mice, and the whole Catwoman phenomenon. I think he means cat lady. Catwoman is something else. Anyway, he gives me a episode. It's a Radiolab show, and it's maybe episode 732, but I'm not sure what that equals means. To continue with Sam's message, starting around 12 minutes and 30 into the episode, it's fascinating to hear the man describe deliberately infecting himself with hookworms to cure his asthma and allergies. Have you heard of that?
No.
Yeah, it's some interesting stuff about parasites.
Wow.
The related stories talks about testing hookworms for diabetes treatment. Also fascinating. But what really caught my attention was the hookworm life cycle itself. How the larvae penetrate the skin, usually through the feet, from walking around barefoot. And they move through the lymph system, up through the legs, and get into the lungs through the lymphatics.
Oh, my God.
Gets better. We're not even halfway through the life cycle. Okay, so then they get coughed up with your phlegm. You know, you cough, you get a little phlegm in your mouth. And, of course, they're an irritant in the lungs, so they make you cough. You cough. You swallow. Now they're in the gut. Once they're in the gut, they actually they mate in the lungs. They get to the gut. Now you're in the infectious form, and they get pooped out. So now you've got in areas where there's poor sanitation, or you know, people pooping in the woods. Those woods have hookworm eggs.
Oh no!
And so they hatch out and re-enter via the skin of bare skin that they sit against and or that sits against them, and it's off to the races. Now, how these things evolve is absolutely insane. But how would that help with asthma and allergies? Now, take a moment and think, what could be going on there? Remember, these are sophisticated organisms, multi-celled, and their job is to live inside your body successfully. So what's their move?
Stay alive.
Stay alive by doing what to the immune system?
Suppressing
the immune system. They don't want to be attacked. So just like cancers, which hide themselves from the immune system, and part of our greatest advance in the last decade in cancer therapy is something called immune checkpoint inhibitors, which keep the cancer's ability to hide, they interfere with that. So they allow the immune system to see the cancers, like pulling off their cloak of invisibility.
Wow.
And in the case of this situation, hookworms and other parasites actually release an immunosuppressant that decreases the amount of inflammatory signals that the host produces. So now there's less, it's a more favorable environment. You've turned down the temperature, so to speak, on the attack against you, such that you can withstand it. And they actually, there's a compound called anti-inflammatory protein number 2. AIP is what they're calling it. It's currently in drug development. It comes from the hookworm.
Wow.
And it does some interesting things. It stimulates those T regulatory cells I was talking about in the context of the vaccine and the autoimmune system and the iris phenomenon. So it stimulates the T regulatory cells, and it increases the good interleukin, which is IL-10. You know, IL-6 is the pro-inflammatory one. IL-1's no good either. Those go way, way up in COVID. IL-10 is actually the peacemaker for the immune system. So it suppresses the immune system. So they actually produce more T regulatory T regulatory cells and a stronger IL-10 production. They also inhibit in the lungs. This is important for the asthma, probably why it works so well there. There's this new compound that just got discovered. They've called it cute. Alarmins. And they are an alarm signal, and they are alarmin. Those alarmins inhibit the production of the inflammatory in the lungs. Now, asthma is an inflammatory disease. So they treat asthma by inhibiting the excess inflammation that is the hallmark of the disease. And they block T cell activation by the antigen presenting cells. So they actually make you less likely to fight off a new infection. So the downside is you're more vulnerable to diseases you don't already have antibodies against.
Mm. Wow.
So truly a double-edged sword. But if they can produce that as a drug, serious possibilities there.
Absolutely.
Well, we have a caller. I'm going to go ahead and pick you up now. And welcome. You're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Deborah. I'm in Santa Cruz.
Hello, Deborah. What can we do for you tonight?
Hi. I have been diagnosed with H. pylori, and I don't want to take the antibiotics for a number of reasons. I've read that the Escalarde probiotic and also that, I don't know how to pronounce it, Ruchery, are both contraindicated for people who have low immunity, and I have low immunity, so I'm kind of scared of taking either of those probiotics.
Well, what does low immunity mean? That's a very what is your diagnosis exactly? Are you on drugs to lower your immunity, or do you get colds easily? Do you have Job syndrome? I mean, what's the?
Yeah, I don't have a diagnosis. I just have pretty much at least half the time I have some kind of a bad virus that's takes a long time, you know, miscellaneous viruses, whatever's going around.
Okay, so these would be respiratory viruses then?
Right? I guess so, you would say so, you know, but they do affect my stomach or, you know, just where you get flu symptoms more or less, you know, the body aches.
Body aches and stuff.
Headaches and all that stuff.
So frequently get viruses. Espolardi is, when they say you shouldn't take it if you're immunosuppressed, they're typically talking about people who are on, like, disease-modifying agents, drugs to suppress the immune system for transplants, I mean, heavy-duty stuff that really takes a SWAT. A tendency to not fight off virus as well is not what they're really talking about there. It's something else. So I would
mention one more thing. I'm sorry. It was probably 30 years ago that I did have a test for my immune system, and the natural killer cells were like practically zero. They were super low, so I don't know.
Well, the natural killer cells are part of what we call the innate immune system. And so they're the first line troops that go out and attack viruses before you have made immunity to them. So it kind of makes sense that you would get every virus, you know, metaphorically. They have flamethrowers, so they make you feel sick, and they make you cough, and they do a lot of damage, but they also keep you from getting sicker. And so everything's getting across your moat, so to speak. And then you're sick for a while until your adaptive immune system kicks in, you know, 7 to 10 days later. So I'm thinking that's probably what's going on. But I'm not going to try to diagnose you on the radio. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. Your question was about H. pylori. And was that discovered because you had symptoms?
Yes.
Okay. And what were your symptoms?
Oh, boy. To describe that, let's see. Yeah. I'm trying to remember what happened, but I ended up going to the ER. I had terrible, terrible pain, I guess, in the stomach area, upper abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
And any food at all made it much worse. And it, I was doubled over for like 2 weeks, probably, in pain.
Sounds like gastritis, which is like an internal sunburn. So anything that stretches the stomach makes you feel terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound familiar?
Yeah. Well, you know what is a weird feeling? It was the feeling of like when someone, like when you're a kid and you get hit by a ball in the stomach and you get the wind blown out of you. Mm-hmm. It was that kind of pain.
I know that pain. I've been there.
Is that a gastritis thing?
That pain when you get the wind knocked out of you, that's actually a visceral pain that is coming from the lungs. And they're trying to pull themselves open, and it's a bit like pulling off a scab inside because the walls...
So that's been like 2 weeks.
Right. Getting back to the H. pylori. Typically what happens in a circumstance like that is that they do an endoscopy, and they go down and look around, and they snip a little piece of... they do something called a CLO test, which actually is a chemical test where if there's H. pylori in the stomach... That test there'll be a color change effectively because H. pylori has an enzyme that breaks down the substance and we don't. So it means that H. pylori is in there and it's done under endoscopy. Another way you can diagnose H. pylori is through stool. And what you may not know, and which I think is really relevant to your case, is if you go out and just test everybody to see how many people have actual H. pylori in their intestines, it's greater than 10% of the population. I don't remember the number, but I just kind of flagged it in my, you know, less than 50, more than 10 category box in my brain. And so it may have been causal to your gastritis because it likes acid and it will increase stomach acid as one of its behaviors. And so... are you still in that pain, or how long since the ER visit and the subsequent 2 weeks for recovery?
That was nearly a year ago,
and it hasn't recurred.
No, but I've been on a bland diet and blending my food, a very limited diet ever since then because of the other symptoms that I had, which were a lot of bloating and gas. And that kind of thing.
There's clearly something going on with your gut health.
Okay.
You know, there's no question there. I'm a little skeptical that you need the antibiotics for H. pylori because you didn't have an ulcer, which is what people usually have, not gastritis.
Oh, let me add one more thing that happened.
Uh-huh.
About 3 months ago, I had just normal blood work done, and my doctor called and said, oh, your cholesterol's beautiful, but I have, my ferritin was down to 9. And that goes with H. pylori.
Well, that goes with bleeding. That goes with bleeding from the H. pylori causing you to have low iron.
I thought the H. pylori uses it as, like, food or something, no? The iron?
Not to my knowledge. That would be news to me. I'm not saying it couldn't be true.
Mm-hmm.
But you got something going on here. I don't think the H. pylori is causing the something. It may be in there and it may be a bystander. Let's get back to can I take Ruteri and can I take Espulardi? There's nothing that you've told me that would make me worry that those would be harmful for you.
Well, that's good to know. Okay. And it was diagnosed through a breath test, by the way.
Okay, so so it's there, but it's in there. Okay, fair enough. The breast test is pretty accurate. It's similar to the CLO test, but yeah. And You know, you had this horrible thing a year ago. It hasn't recurred. What were the other X factors that allowed it to happen then that are keeping it from happening now? And, you know, so if it's almost like, I think you're barking up the wrong tree with the antibiotics, but I think they found something they want to treat and they're hoping it'll work. And I'm a functional medicine doctor who, you know, thinks of the gut as a dynamic system. And so I'm like, well, why don't you send me a more elaborate letter as an email? You can go to askdrdawn.com and you can, as long as I have your permission to read it, you know, I'll analyze the case just for the entertainment and edification of my listeners.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Dawn.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Have a good
night. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, we've still got a few minutes, so how about if I give you my medical news of the weird, Mira?
Yes, please.
Okay. This sounds like an Edgar Allan Poe story, The Twice-Born Babe.
Ooh.
So a Florida baby was actually taken out of the womb, effectively being born, by C-section at 25 weeks to undergo surgery. And then was put back, and the uterus sewed up, and born again at full term.
Whoa.
Yeah, I'm there. Whoa.
My gosh.
So baby Cassian was diagnosed in utero at 19 weeks with a rare congenital abnormality called congenital high airway obstruction syndrome. And you got to know they went for this acronym, CHAOS. Because that's what it's going to be in the delivery room when the baby's not breathing and you're bagging the baby and you've intubated the baby and the baby's still blue.
No.
Wait. Huh? What? It's an unusually fatal defect in which a thick membrane blocks the fetus's airway and traps fluid in the lungs. The condition occurs in about 1 in 50,000 births and is pretty much lethal. Very few survive. So they tried first in utero laser surgery, and that didn't work. So then they did this Hail Mary pass where they opened up mom's uterus, pulled the baby partially out, arms and head, out of the body, still attached to the placenta, sterile situation and all of that. So a surgeon came in and created the airway, just built the airway using an endoscope. And then they tucked the baby back in, so fold the baby up, tucked them back in the uterus, and closed up the uterus. And 6 weeks later, he was born, and not quite full term, but full enough, 31 weeks, to weigh a whopping 3 pounds.
Wow. So
spent a while in the intensive care unit, but made it home for Christmas. And his mother, Kishira Joubert, says that they're going to celebrate 2 birthdays. For the rest of his life, a small party for his surgery, and then, of course, a big party for his birth.
That's a lucky kid.
Yeah, 2 sets of birthday presents, no lie.
All the kids are going to be saying, Mom, wasn't I born twice?
The fact that we can do that and is just intensely, crazily mind-blowing.
And the endoscopic technique, I mean, those tools and all of that must be so tiny.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Little baby tools. I guess we're going to call them not even neonatal, the prenatal surgeons. I'm sure that's going to be a serious specialty.
Yeah.
We have, you know, in the fun fact about how we divide things up, the eye isn't very big, right? But it's very complicated. And so we have 2 sets of eye doctors. We have the anterior chamber doctors who operate between the iris and the cornea. And we have the posterior chamber doctors who work between the back of the iris and the retina. And never the twain shall meet. They have different equipment. They have different surgical skills. And there's no such thing really as a general ophthalmologist.
Wow.
They're mostly anterior chamber guys, you know. They're cool. They're laid back. It's the retina guys who are intense.
Yeah.
And then orthopedic surgery is another one. So, you know, you have the orthopedic surgeons, and they take care of, they have the big silver hammers, and they knock, you know, they saw off bits of your hip and your knee and put in brand new joints and, you know, rods and bones and all of that. But they're just not the guys to handle the hand.
No.
So what happened with plastic surgery is that plastic surgery and hand surgery overlap in the same specialty, because little tiny tools, a very, very good eye-hand coordination, the ability to work in high magnification and make little tiny movements. And so we had to partition medicine according to the scale of the job.
Wow.
And I once got to do microsurgery during a plastics rotation in Texas. And what's crazy is you have this operating microscope, which is about 10x, maybe 15 or 20x, I don't remember. But you have this suture that is thinner than a human hair, and a little tiny curved needle, and little tiny tweezers. And the cool thing is that if you can see it, your hands are capable, or at least mine were at 24, of actually sewing up this artery, which you could, it would look like a line drawn with a pen on a piece of paper it with the naked eye. But under magnification, you can do things like that. It's just like the people who do the IVF. They're actually looking at the egg and, coming forward with the sperm in a syringe, and they're just like penetrating the egg with the needle and then squirting this one sperm in there.
Wow.
And then pulling the needle out, and the egg just closes right up. It doesn't pop like a bubble.
Wow.
It doesn't pop. So the body is amazing, and I'm looking forward to telling you more yarns about it. It's lovely to have an interlocutor. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.